I'll learn something today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Rebecca Wee.
And I'm Don Wooten. Kelly Daniels teaches creative writing, and I could use some lessons on Scribble. But I don't think we could do it in the time we have.
Teach you something?
Well, you know, but the very idea you're going to teach something creative, I think, isn't that a confusion of terms or something?
I don't think so. I mean, every other art form has a mentorship program. You know, the great painters of the Renaissance all served under a master painter and did half of that person's paintings by the end, if you believe the art history, I guess. And I think creative writing has just come late to the game for reasons just random reasons. And I think that there's still this idea that it can't be taught, which I think is kind of a lingering myth. And it might also have something to do with just the definition of taught. If you think of teaching as I'm going to turn you into this thing that you want to be, or I want you to be, and as long as you go through the program, you're going to be it at the end, then that's asking for too much. And I don't think any field can quite do that. Maybe some kind of simple.
Isn't that something you want to avoid? I was always worried when I was teaching because I've emulated a teacher I loved and wanted to be him, and then I realized, no, I can't do that. And so I was always worried that my students might be motivated to be in any way like me, and I wanted them to be individuals.
I don't know about Kelly, but I don't think mine want to be like me. I think to take Kelly's point, you're not going to get brilliant writers out of all of them, just like, you know, the band director isn't going to get brilliant musicians or the painter isn't. But, you know, you usually do find one or two who, you know, either know or haven't discovered yet how good they are and that they love it. I guess that's the thing, don't you?
Well, at least they develop an appreciation for writing.
Well, yeah. I the best analogy I can come up with is coaching. I don't think a coach can't turn a bad basketball player into a great three-point shooter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the coach can help that person's natural talent along and also just give a space for the person to practice. And the way you get good at shooting baskets is you sit there shooting baskets all day, every day, for months and years. And that's really what I do in creative writing is, hey, as long as you're with me, you're going to write, and I'll help you kind of make minor adjustments then let you go. And it's up to you from there. So I think it's important to be modest as a creative writing professor or instructor of what you can do and not pretend that you can do more. Yeah.
Well, you touched on a sore point there. Discipline.
Basketball?
Discipline. I have cited over and over again Leo Nucci, an operatic baritone, who in a famous interview says, I spent 2 years singing scales. 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
But as a result, he was flawless. But the idea for me to put in time like that is repellent.
Yeah. Well, the students who love it or who discover that something's happening when they write, you know, yeah, there won't be more than a couple of those in a group. But even the ones that maybe aren't gifted suddenly see it differently, and that's really fun, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's also nice if I develop some more readers.
Yeah.
So people who actually like to read novels and poems and short stories and get something out of it. And learning to become a good reader is the first step in becoming a better writer. The discipline thing, some people get away with doing less practice than others. And other people really are grinders, and they just put the time in and they get better that way. And then some of us, just doesn't matter how hard we practice, we probably aren't going to ever be great. But hey, you know, everybody's different and finds their own place.
I remember a kid in high school who was slow. I mean, just you could tell that his mind didn't work that fast. But he was told early on by a teacher that he's going to have to work harder than others. And when our professor would ask a question, you could see him, you could see the wheels start to turn in his mind. And about the time the professor was going to move to another topic, he gave the answer spot on.
Yeah.
And I admired him. That son of a gun edged me in that class.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, we value fast thinking in this culture, and we don't value deep thinking as much. And I just don't think a quick mind is a certain kind of skill, no mm-hmm. doubt about it, and it's useful in a lot of ways. But it isn't the only skill. It's not the only thing that's useful. And sometimes it masks weaknesses that we miss. So I think slowly going over it can really be just as powerful or more so in different ways than your really quick thinker. So
yeah.
Yeah, but going over my writing slowly is so discouraging. I think, oh no, let's change that. Or where did that come from?
You mean in revision? Are you talking revision? Revision's a whole different thing.
At some point you think, let's just throw this away. But are there certain fundamentals you give them? You know, one of the things about classical music that people don't think about is the structure in it is what gives it real strength.
Yeah.
It has great emotion and so on and inspiration, but the structure is what sustains it. Is the same thing true in writing?
Oh, yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just this morning finished reading a book by George Saunders, who's a great short story writer. At least one person said the greatest short story writer of this century so far. And his latest book is a book on teaching, and it's seven classic Russian stories that he's been teaching for 20 years. And he finally wrote the teaching into a book. So you read the story, say Chekhov's The Darling, and then he goes over it almost line by line. This is where he's going, and it's always structure. He's like, you get this emotional charge at the end, and people are like, oh, it's magic. He just, Chekhov had that magic. And he goes, no, it's the structure. And when a story doesn't work right, it's a structural flaw. You're missing something. And even brought that into the realm of, let's say, social justice, because a student was complaining about a Tolstoy story that it was classist because he didn't give the same amount of interiority to the peasant character as he did to the master character. And the master character gets to kind of have a big epiphany and change his life from a terrible person to a good. The peasant stays the same all along. And for Tolstoy, the peasant was like, oh, they're just the salt of the earth. He's dismissive of him. And Saunders said, instead of thinking about it in terms of politics or class and all that, think about it in technique. This is a technical flaw that came out of Tolstoy's kind of his weakness in that one area of thinking. I just think that's kind of a interesting way to approach problems that we may elevate to bigger societal problems. But if you're actually teaching creative writing, it's more useful to think of it as a technical problem, a structural problem, because then it's fixable.
Right, right.
But exactly. Along comes the novel Lincoln and the Bardo. I'd never seen a novel like that. It was just one quotation after another from these spirits. And they commented on what Lincoln was doing and so on. And I thought, it's as if their world is the real world. The spirit world somehow has a reality. I'd never seen anything put together quite like that.
Yeah, it's an amazing novel. I would posit, and I hope I'm not stepping on my own foot, but that Saunders is much better short story writer than novelist. I thought it was a really interesting novel. It was built on what I guess you could ungenerously say is a gimmick, that it's a ghost story. To me, by the end of it, I didn't feel that charge of interest and insight and emotion that I do when I read his stories. And this whole Chekhov book, it's called Swimming in a Pond in the Rain, which is from Chekhov's Gooseberries. is it kind of reinforced that he really is a story writer. He thinks in small, in 25-page increments. And I kind of think I shouldn't criticize George Saunders. He's such a great writer. But at least my reading experience of Lincoln and the Bardo, I thought it was really fascinating and an interesting experiment. But for me, as a novel, it didn't quite deliver the goods the way I wanted.
It was a great experiment, but so was a Ulysses. And I do not include that as a great novel.
Ulysses?
Yeah.
I wish you'd had Dr. McDowell here, because his whole identity is built around that novel, so would get riled up. Even more so, Finnegan's Wake. I mean, nobody can read past the first page, and yet people say, well, it's a great novel. Not that I've read it, but...
Well, try Proust if you want to try to get past the first page, for Pete's sake. Those Madeleines, by the way, Madeleines are very tasty.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I'm a fan.
So before we run out of time, let's have Kelly read something and talk about your own work. I know you're being humble, but let's...
You have a book that you have written. Give us the name.
It's my first novel, my second book. It's called A Candle for San Simon. Mm-hmm. And it is a literary thriller. The literary part is that it's a father-son story, and it's about relationships, and there's some love stories. And the thriller part is there's a bunch of bad gangsters with guns and shooting people up and all that. Takes place mainly in Guatemala. There's some drug cartel baddies, and then a alcoholic expatriate that drives a bus for a living, his born-again Christian son, the English teacher, lover, and then a femme fatale gangster woman who is terrifying and breathtaking.
Well, you got them all in there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So anyway, that's my novel, which was published in August of 2020, right in time to not be able to do any kind of readings or anything. And so poor me. But, you know, there were a lot of novels published in that year, and it was a little disappointing, but... But yeah, there it is.
Okay, give us a sample.
Okay. Yeah, let's sell some books.
I'll just, I'm just going to read the first couple paragraphs.
Okay.
By way of teaser, I'll just say chapter two starts the kind of extreme shocking violence of the thriller part.
Yeah,
chapter one is more the easing into the literary story. But yeah, I'll just read the first paragraph. An old flat-faced school bus, home-painted turquoise with pale orange fenders and roof, sped east along the Pan-American Highway just outside of Quetzaltenango, Guatemala. Dark foliage covered peaks rising to the north and south into a low ceiling of clouds, and garbage lined the road, the old rubbish dissolving into the forest fringe and making way for the freshly tossed water bottles, bright wrappers, and the occasional plump garbage bag, some split and spilling, others intact. Civilization fell away beyond the outskirts, the highway hugging the mountainside, while the highland valley, green and dotted with primitive family farms, rolled off to the passenger side. Norman Carruthers, a white man, middle-aged with a full head of pale hair and a rum-burnt face, drove the bus, bouncing gently on the spring-loaded seat. He let off the accelerator, frowning through the windshield at the line of brake lights clustered ahead. An accident, he figured, a bad one. I'll stop there, and I'll just say that it's a government, or it's some kind of military checkpoint,
yeah.
And then that's where the trouble starts.
But that's very well written.
Thank you.
I mean, you see everything,
uh-huh.
And it is so clear. That's good.
I did a reading, a book launch with masks and stuff. It was like the one event. It was in the parking lot of a bookstore, and somebody introduced me, and he gave a big, detailed explication of that first paragraph. It was 10 times smarter than I ever could have been. Everything meant something. Oh, the old trash means this, and then the new trash is this, and they're leaving civilization. And at the end, I'm like, yeah.
That's, you got
yeah,
it.
That, yeah.
You got it.
You saw right into my soul.
Isn't it interesting how, and this is the thing that's fascinated me in the things I've written. I will hear from people I'll read this and I think, where did they get that? And I'll go back and read it again and think, is that anywhere in here? Because I didn't see it.
Well, you just go, well, I'm brilliant. I'm a lot smarter than... I do think that our writer selves are smarter than our selves.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think it's the discipline and the practice that allows us to speak to... And I think that's why the Greeks and so many others believed in the muse and prayed to the muse, because it feels like it's coming from outside. And maybe it is.
Yeah.
Well, there are times when you're writing when all of a sudden the stuff just flows.
Yeah.
And you do wonder, where did that come from?
Yeah.
And that's what every writer, I think, longs for.
And you don't necessarily get it.
No, you
often.
Don't.
Oh. You know, most of it's the hard work, and then you get the day or the prompt or whatever.
I promise you, it doesn't always come. It seldom comes.
Well, it's... I mean, that's fun to watch in the students, too, because they grind away at it and suddenly, you know, something takes off and they recognize that they're kind of, they are and they are not in charge.
But of course, you're more poetry and Kelly is more fiction and nonfiction, right?
Yeah. And Rebecca also teaches nonfiction, creative nonfiction.
Do they let you do that, Rebecca?
They do let me do that.
Poets are natural fits for personal essay form and memoir and stuff, I really think. And some of the best – and actually some of the best novels are written by poets. And I almost hate to say that. But one of my favorite fiction writers is Dennis Johnson. And, of course, he didn't turn to fiction until he had 3 full books of poetry published.
Yeah.
And that ability to use language at that level, that granular level, just made him such a fantastic novelist.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's, you know, you are going to a conference of some kind next Saturday. What's going on?
That's right. It is called the Luther College Writers Festival. I think that's what they're calling it this year. It's been going along for a long time, I think Rebecca said, and it might have changed names over the years.
It's had some different incarnations, but yeah, it's been going for a while. I think that at some point they decided, I think that the impulse felt like it was too much about religious scholarship and writing, and it wasn't necessarily, but...
Yeah, this is a writing festival. There's a whole bunch of writers coming. My friend Peter Guy, who's a novelist, he writes these northern Minnesota, sort of like living out in the woods and cutting the timber and kind of stories. And anyway, I should have like reviewed the keynote speakers and stuff, but it's a big festival, 2 days. Mm-hmm. And I'm super excited. I love Decora.
Yeah.
And,
so what do you do at a conference like that?
You just kind of wing it, I guess, because nobody's told me what I'm supposed to do. But
that hasn't changed.
I'm in a panel with some other novelists, and I think that they said that, how about you guys read a little bit and then have a conversation? I'm like, all right, sounds good. And this is all on email. Everybody's like, yep, sounds good to me. Yeah. So I guess that's what our panel is going to be.
I did that conference years and years ago. Well, I guess when my book came out, and that's exactly what we did, and it works. It's beautiful. You'll love it. You'll just
– yeah.
I mean, you go to sessions, you sign books, you read, you have panels, you meet a lot of – that's where I met – do you know Jill Alexander Esbaum?
Yeah.
So that was where I first met her. She was there reading from her first book. And
but don't writers also go to conferences where agents are prowling about?
Not at
Luther. That's the myth. That's the story. I don't know how true it is. There are some conferences where they'll have an agent or two there that will hear pitches. Those are usually conferences where the wannabe writer pays a couple thousand bucks for the opportunity. This is a free thing. It's an academic thing. It's just for the celebration of writing and writers.
Yeah.
And I think it's more of a party than a commercial exchange.
Yeah.
I think some people do end up getting agents through these kind of, you pay to go and you meet the agent. But it also has a feeling of commerce to it, that you're paying for your chance, pay to play kind of a thing. So,
and you know, in this era of self-publishing, are agents still so sought after by writers? Because if you're published, a friend of mine wrote a series of very successful books and was living on crumbs. because the you know, it didn't hit the bestseller list. Mm-hmm. And so she wrote, I think, 20 books in all, and they were steadily used, very popular, more popular in England than in this country. But she went through a regular publisher. If she had self-published, I think she'd have been financially more secure.
The average number of books that a self-published book, there's like hundreds of thousands published per year, and usually they sell under 100 copies, kind of. I mean, my numbers may be wrong. Uh-huh. But the thing is, you could say, oh, I'm not making enough because of my contract. They're taking a bunch. But they're the ones that are distributing your book and getting it in Barnes & Nobles. And they're the reason why you get reviewed at the New York Times. New York Times won't review a self-published book unless Stephen King decides. And, you know, if you're a famous writer who already has readers, then by all means, if you think you can make more money just distributing your own literature and printing your own books through Amazon, then you can do that. And maybe that works out financially. But the stories of people self-published books selling a million copies are really exceptions. And by all means, go for it. I feel like there's a stigma against self-published books. And part of the reason is that they're not edited. There's a lot of self-published books that are very shoddy. Yeah. And I hope I don't hurt anybody's feelings. Not all of them are that way. But if you're in that group, readers can just assume, if you're self-published, then you're going to be one of those kind of books.
I know.
Yeah. It's you do need good editing. And when you produce a book, do you give it to someone to edit? Or do you edit yourself?
Well, I edit it as much as I can. My books are published. My two books are published through a small press, and they have a small staff that did some editing and gave editorial advice. Certainly if you're published traditionally through like one of the legacy publishers, the big five publishers, as they call them, there's a whole professional series of editors. When I publish with the magazine called The Sun, there's a really stringent editorial process where you go through multiple rounds of editing, and they'll tell you what to do, and then they'll tell you to undo it, and then you can fight with them about it. As far as me just working on my own stuff before I'm ready to send it to somebody, I do feel like it's important to have a couple of people read it before I start showing it to, you know, people who can actually make decisions about whether it's going to be published or not. I think that's a wise thing to do, because we can sometimes fool ourselves to think that things are better than they are.
Yeah.
One way or the other, you better edit it. I mean, I just don't think anybody's writing first draft novels and then hitting send on Amazon and then it's a great book. That's, to me, I think, basically impossible.
I was once offered the chance to publish a book of columns, and I did. But as I look at it later on, I think, boy, this should have been submitted to somebody who would be critical, and the way it was organized and other things like that. So it didn't surprise me that, it didn't break into the bestseller list. We sold a few hundred, I guess, but that was it.
Yeah.
And are you working on another book? Surely you don't stop.
Yeah, I am. Yep, I'm working on a novel right now.
And you want to tell us what?
I thought about that, and I've decided that I'm one of those people that feel superstitious about it. That it's not just superstition. When I was a MFA student, I would tell everybody that, oh, you're a writer, you're an MFA student. What are you doing? Oh, I'm working on a story collection. 3 years later, where's that story collection? And it, of course, was never published because I wasn't ready and I wasn't as good as I thought I was. And so there's just the embarrassment, like making promises that you don't know that you can, that you can deliver on. It just sets you up to be embarrassed. But also a lot of writers, if you kind of Google it and read, because I did that recently. And it does seem to be a widespread phenomenon that writers feel like if they start talking about their works in progress, it saps their energy to actually write it, because it you're sort of taking a shortcut to get to the satisfaction of getting of right. hearing people talk about what it is you're doing, but you haven't done the thing yet.
Yeah.
So I think it's better to just, and I'm not trying to be coy or mysterious. It's just that I'm working on a novel. I'm excited about it. It may or may not hit the bookshelves at a bookstore near you one day. But the moment it does, I will talk about it on this program and every other radio station in America and elsewhere. But in the meantime, I'm just going to say I'm working on a novel.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be working on 3 books, and I have written zip. So it's, and I'm hoping that time will free me of this obligation at some point.
I like how you articulated that, Kelly, because one of my teachers in my MFA program said she was even against keeping notebooks and taking notes. She just said, if you feel the urgency to sit down and write something, then put it into the project, not in notes that you will come back to later. She said you're just losing, you're sort of giving away the tension that would bring you to the page to do the work.
Oh, I never look at my notes. Like I write notebooks, I'll never crack them again. They've been sitting there for 15 years in boxes.
There's something about, memory, I guess, that it's, I always kind of want to know that it's there if I want to go look for it. But you're right, I don't go back to my journals very often.
Yeah, well, I don't journal anyway. It's so I am lazy. I mean, that's my great gift.
Well, laziness is actually a motivation to be efficient.
Yeah,
and
true.
I really do think that's right. Too. When you don't really want to sit around scribbling all day, speaking of scribble, then you're going to make it count when you do. And I believe in that. I believe in like doing it seriously and focused rather than just reflexively. I guess Joyce Carol Oates is famous for writing in notebooks while she's at other people's readings.
Oh yeah,
she's sitting in the back just writing and making.
Oh, I do that.
Everybody hate her.
I do that. Not,
everybody loves you. You sort of get away with it. Oh, because you're writing notes about their thing. They think.
Well, that might be it. But there is something about listening to somebody else's flow or language or whatever, that it's like listening to music or something where you just feel like I'm in this and I need to. Don Hall would have said, I love it so much I want to make something like what I love. And that's what kind of inspires me.
I've noticed you writing.
I do it here. It's kind of, I feel like I can't really think or remember if I haven't.
And I always think, what is she? What was that just said that has to be noted? Listen, we're about done here, but have a good time at the conference next Saturday.
Thank you very much, and I think it's free and open to the public. So if anybody wants to go,
drive to Decorah.
Yeah, but it's outside my home, so I'm not sure that I'll be there. But and when you are working on your next novel or at the right stage, give us a call.
We'll
do. Love to hear. Kelly Daniels has been our guest today, and that'll do it for this session. I'm Don Wooten with Rebecca Wee. We've enjoyed your company. Hope we'll have it again next week for the next Scribble.